This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. February 14th will mark the sixth anniversary of the fatwa, or death warrant, issued by the Ayatollah Khomeini against writer Salman Rushdie. The late leader of Iran put a $1 million price on Rushdie's head, condemning his novel The Satanic Verses as blasphemy. Rushdie has lived in hiding ever since, protected by special police from London's Scotland Yard. But as we're about to hear, he's been surfacing more and more, trying to lead a slightly more normal life. In fact, earlier today, he went to the NPR Bureau in London to talk with us about his new collection of short stories called East West. The theme of cultural displacement runs throughout the book. Rushdie grew up in Bombay and was educated in London, where he decided to stay. One story in his new book, called The Auction of the Ruby Slippers, is about the people bidding on the magical slippers from the Wizard of Oz. Fundamentalists want to acquire the slippers so they can destroy the slippers. That's okay with the liberal auctioneers, who think, what's the point of tolerance if the intolerant are not tolerated also? I asked Rushdie if he thinks that's the attitude some liberals have toward the Muslim militants who want to destroy him.
I do think one of the interesting things that has been raised by the whole thing that happened to me, in which that story tries a little bit to discuss, is what is the limit of a tolerant society? In the story, of course, it becomes a satire about capitalism. They say anyone's money is as good as anyone else's, and if people have the top bid and want to buy these things to burn them, then that's fair enough. Well, I think, I guess the author's view is that that might not be fair enough, but I'm biased.
Well, I think your story, too, is, in a way, a satire about the limits of multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's true. There's a passage in there somewhere about rage, but how it seems that rage has become, if you like, a new value. That if you can lay claim to a certain degree of rage, it seems to entitle almost any sort of bad behavior. And the more rage you can claim to feel, the worse you're allowed to behave. This is a new phenomenon, really. The idea of anger as being self-justifying, but it is, I think, something thrown up by the multiculturalist issue.
What are your latest feelings about the support or lack of support you've gotten from the Islamic intellectual community?
The Islamic intellectual community, I must say, has came out quite strongly a year or so ago, and there was a book which I think has been published in the States, in which 100 or so leading intellectuals from the Muslim world, spoke up on my behalf, and that was very important, I think, because it exploded the Islamist myth that this is in some way a West versus East struggle, and it went to show that there's plenty of voices in the East who feel as I do, and perhaps what prevented them speaking up before is that people were trying to scare them.
Oh, I want to get back to the idea of the limits of multiculturalism. Do you feel that some people who might otherwise speak out against any kind of death sentence that's put on a writer's head have been reluctant to do so because they feel they can't pass judgment on another culture or another religion?
Well, I think perhaps of all the many stupidities around this issue, that's probably been one of the most stupid. And the idea that to object to the murder of somebody for writing a book is somehow culturally specific as an objection, and there must be other cultures in which it's fine to kill people for writing books. It seems to me that's multiculturalism gone mad. There has been little of that. And I hope that kind of attitude is dying away at the moment, because the obvious fact is that free speech is not a value specific to Western culture. It's specific to all cultures, and there are many people fighting on behalf of that value in Islamic countries, in the East generally, in the Third World generally, and having to fight against it in a way that's much more real than anyone in the United States, because quite often their safety is at issue in a way that it's not in the West. So then to demean them by saying, well, actually, it's not your culture, seems to me to heap insult on injury.
The sixth anniversary of the fatwa is coming up February 14th. It's just a couple of weeks away. Is there any new hope on the horizon or any changes in strategy that you have planned?
As far as political hope, I don't think there is. I don't think anybody's doing very much about it. I myself have really reached the point of what one can only call boredom with the fatwa. I'm trying more and more to lead as much of an ordinary writer's life as I possibly can, and as far as possible to ignore the thing. Obviously, it's not possible to really ignore it completely, but as far as I can, I am. And I think one of the things that's important for me, having a book of stories out, is that for a change, there's a way in which I can speak again as a writer instead of as this kind of political hot potato. And in addition to the stories, of course, I've just finished a novel, so there's that's just gone into the publishers. And I think the best thing I can do is to go on being the writer I've always been. You know, the best way of answering any attempt at censorship is simply not to be censored and to proceed. And I think a thing that I do feel take some pride in is that I have continued and I am continuing as a writer. And increasingly my interest is to do my work and to discuss my work and let the rest of it go hang, frankly.
Are you saying that you've given up hope of actually getting the fatwa revoked, so now your strategy is to just try to live with it?
I haven't given up the hope, no. I mean, I think it's very important that the fatwa is cancelled. I think it's a fantastic assault on the integrity of free societies and on the rights of individuals in those societies. I don't see any political initiative to get this thing sorted out. I wish there were, but I don't see it. And it's always been the case that this has not been a problem for me to solve. It's always been something that needed to be solved at government-to-government level. Now, if nothing's happening, there's really very little I can do about it except to proceed with my life. So that's what I'm trying to do.
If you managed, or if international efforts managed to get the fatwa revoked, would you still live in some fear that there would be Islamic vigilantes on
your
town?
Not really. I think this is a kind of figment of the very colorful imaginations of the general public and of the journalistic community. The fact is that in this entire period, I've experienced a lot of support from ordinary Muslims around the world, and there has been no effort to injure me in any way that has not been directly connected to the government of Iran. I mean, those are the people who are up to no good, and no one else. So, I mean, yes, there might be a sort of residual problem of the occasional hooligan, but I must say, I think probably the average movie star or rock musician would face a bigger problem than me.
I don't know if this is a question you can answer or not, but have there been direct attempts on your life in the past few years?
Oh, well, not in the sense that they haven't ever got anywhere close to me, but certainly I've been made aware by intelligence sources from time to time that there were, in their view, attempts being made. Not in the very recent past, but certainly, yes, there have been efforts that we've been aware of.
Could you discuss any of them, or would it be best not to?
Well, it's difficult to say in too much detail, but the fact is that in the last few years, a number of people with Iranian connections, or actually Iranian citizens, have been expelled from this country. And the reason they were expelled was certainly because they were here for reasons connected with the fatwa. In the last case of that was a couple of years ago, and the people involved were, in I think two of the three cases, actually working at the Iranian mission in London. So the connection was very clear. I wish this were not so, but it is so, that there is one government in the world that appears to think that killing people is fine. This is not, that's to say, a general problem of the Islamic world versus Salman Rushdie. It's a specific problem of a government that kills its own citizens all the time, that murders its own writers, tortures and jails its own writers. Recently, a very distinguished Iranian writer died in jail, quotes accidentally, unquotes, an official explanation that no one believes. All they're doing in this case is to seek to export that technique.
You are the writer best known to Americans who has a fatwa that's been imposed by militant Islamic fundamentalists, but there are others as well. Would you care to mention a couple of them and to put yourself into that context?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, I think the thing that people, I think, perhaps haven't realized is that this technique of using religious decrees to attempt to silence free speech is one being used more and more across the world, not just in Iran. I mean, the Iranian fatwa against me is well known. But, for instance, the Egyptian Nobel Prize laureate Najib Mahfouz was threatened in a similar way by religious authorities in his country, and within the last couple of months was actually attacked as a result of this and stabbed in the neck. And although he's a very old gentleman, he did very fortunately survive, I'm glad to say, but nevertheless that was a direct result of a fatwa. Similar cases have occurred in Turkey, where money has been offered for the deaths of writers who have been criticized by religious authorities, or in Bangladesh, where a fatwa was issued against one writer recently, and in many other countries, and notably at the moment, one would say, in Algeria, where the religious fanatical forces in that country have embarked upon a campaign of almost deliberate campaign of assassinating writers and journalists as much as possible. And people are being killed for virtually no money at all. I mean, let's say the bounty money being involved is petty, but people are being murdered, you know, for a couple of cents.
What do you think the international community should do or could do about these attacks against writers?
Well, I mean, clearly there is plenty that can be done. In my case, it's actually easiest because we're talking here about a British citizen living in England, who is to be defended against an extraterritorial illegal act. Of course, the issue of what happens when people are in their own countries and being attacked by their own states is more complex. But in many cases, these are states, such as Bangladesh, very dependent on Western assistance. And it's perfectly possible, if one wishes to use that economic lever on human rights cases, to do so. Unfortunately, it seems as if Western countries are rather reluctant to use economic levers on human rights issues. Notably in the case of China, another country in which free speech, free expression is being severely repressed. The methods are there if people want to use them. I mean, the worrying thing is that governments of the so-called free world who claim to stand up for these issues don't seem very interested in using those levers.
Salman Rushdie is my guest. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Salman Rushdie, and he, by the way, has a new collection of short stories called East West. You know, so often you write in metaphor, in parable, in one case you wrote a fairy tale. Do you comprehend literalists, people who take everything literally, including the Bible or the Quran?
Well, I mean, of course I comprehend them because I write about them too. But it seems to me that it's a particularly unintelligent view of the world. I mean, that's to say, if you were to say to me whether I thought the sacred texts were beautiful, whether they contained evocative images or had meaning as poetry and so on, and of course they are in many cases texts of extremely high literary value of that sort. But if you ask me whether I really think that archangels stand on the horizon and fill the sky and dictate to people on top of a mountain the uncreated word of God, I mean, that's say, if I'm supposed to accept that as a literal truth, then obviously I don't. If that's blasphemy, then that's blasphemy. And it doesn't really, I mean, it seems to be the idea of blasphemy, long ago exploded idea in the free world. It would be very dangerous to allow that idea to resurface now, because basically all that blasphemy says is a way of telling people, shut up. It's a way of saying, you can't think this because I tell you to. Now, actually, the whole history of the fight for free expression in Europe during the 18th century Enlightenment, which was the basis of the world's idea of free speech, that whole fight was a fight not against the state, but against the church. That's to say, writers like Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot and the writers of the Enlightenment, deliberately used blasphemy, deliberately used the idea of speaking up against religious sacred cows, if you like, in order to create the notion that free speech was not for the church or the Inquisition or any other religious body to control. And out of that comes the Western notion of free speech.
Did you grow up with literalism?
No, not really. No, I mean, the country I grew up in, you know, is a secular democratic state, India. The family I grew up in was very committed to those ideas and was the least literalist or least actually not particularly religious family. There was, in my childhood and my growing up days in India, very little in the way of Islamic fundamentalism, which is really a worldwide phenomenon that's only happened in the last 20 years. There was very little in those days in the way of Hindu fundamentalism, which there now also is in India. I mean, religious extremism of this type simply did not exist in India and Pakistan in those days. When fundamentalists talk about, you know, having the only true version of reality, it is worth reminding ourselves, first of all, that this is only 20 years old, and secondly, that what we call fundamentalism is not a religious movement, but a political movement, an attempt to control the state by using certain very extreme versions of theological dogma.
So you don't at all feel that your writing violates a tradition you were brought up in?
No, it doesn't. Certainly discusses it. In many cases, it dissents from it. But I think that's what all writers do with all traditions. I don't think tradition is a straitjacket. Tradition is something to rip apart and trample on. You know, how would you have the history of art in any country if people simply went on reverentially saying traditional things? Tradition is very important. It gives you a framework. It gives you something to think about. But it also gives you something to kick out against and argue about and change. I mean, I come from a generation that believed in social change and intellectual change and artistic change. And I think that's what I've always tried to devote my writing to, not to some kind of moribund reverence for the past.
What are some of the ways in which you think you've changed in the past 6 years?
Well, I've got a lot older. There's that.
How old are you now?
Well, I'll be 48 this year, but so this has been more or less all my 40s. That's annoying. You know, I feel as if I've lost a lot of useful living time, which I could have done a lot more with if I'd been permitted to. I don't know. I think I'm really more interested at the moment in how my writing's developed, and I think one of the things that I was pleased about in these stories was that I felt that I'd been able to break through, if you like, into a certain number of new kinds of writing. The stories in the middle section, for instance, are in which you mentioned the Ruby Slipper story, but the other two stories there, the one about Christopher Columbus and the one about Yorick, are new ways for me to look at Western culture by, if you like, deconstructing and reconstructing various iconic figures in that culture. And the last section of stories, which are about the meeting points, if you like, the crossover points between the East and the West that I know, that's to say India and England, allowed me to find, if you like, a much more personal voice. A lot of those stories come from more directly autobiographical material, perhaps, than some of my stuff, and are perhaps more directly emotional than some of my stuff. And I was pleased to be able to do that. And I wanted to write more personal, emotional writing in that way. And that's one of the things that I think I've done more of.
I wonder if you ever want to write the kind of autobiography that would probably be too dangerous for you to write right now, because you'd have to reveal things that you maybe
reveal. The funny thing is, yes, probably is the answer. It had always seemed to me completely unnecessary for novelists to write autobiographies. Until this thing happened to me, it had never, ever occurred to me that I would write an autobiography. But I do seem to have been cursed with an interesting life. And if one has a life like this, then in the end you do want to tell its story.
So do you have any way of keeping a journal that absolutely nobody would have access to so you can record what's happening in your life?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've kept quite a careful journal throughout this time. So it's all there.
Does writing give you any more or less pleasure than it used to?
Well, just recently, it depends what day you ask me that question. Really.
Right.
Just because I happen to have completed a collection of stories recently and delivered a novel last Friday, just at the moment, I'm feeling rather good about my writing. I'm feeling a certain glow of achievement. I think writing is writing, and when it's going well, it does make you feel good, and when it's going bad, it makes you feel dreadful and stupid. But I don't think, in general, my attitude to it has altered, except in the regard that I feel it very important that I demonstrate to all concerned that I am not being silenced by this thing. And I am continuing to write, and I'm not also simply becoming a creature of the threat. I don't wish to be a writer who can be defined only in terms of this threat, because I'm another kind of writer. And I hope that what happened in England will now happen in America, because when these stories were published in England, one of the great delights of that publication was that, broadly speaking, the people who reviewed the book on its own terms. I mean, reviewed it as a work of fiction, as a work of literature, and expressed their liking or otherwise for it in those terms. From what I can see of the beginnings of the American publication and the very flattering reviews that have appeared there, people are able to do that there as well. And so that's a way back for me. That's a way of saying I'm not just this curious, invisible figure with a knife hanging over his head, but I'm, in fact, if one was to say it most simply, I hope, a comic writer.
Salman Rushdie. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. Rushdie has a new collection of short stories called East West. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Salman Rushdie. For nearly 6 years, he's lived with a death warrant issued against him by the Ayatollah Khomeini, the late Islamic fundamentalist leader of Iran. The death warrant is punishment for Rushdie's novel The Satanic Verses, but it hasn't stopped him from writing. His new book is a collection of short stories called East West. Our interview was recorded earlier today at the NPR Bureau in London. The other two times that we've spoken on Fresh Air, it was by telephone, and you joined us by phone from an undisclosed location.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're at a studio, I know where you are. Of course, we're recording, and by the time this conversation is on the air, you won't be there anymore.
Yeah.
But why are you able to do that now, whereas you weren't for the previous times that we spoke?
Well, just because I'm tired of being shut up in a room. I mean, it seems to me that it's perfectly possible, and indeed I've been doing it quite a lot recently, to lead most of a normal life while still being cautious. I mean, that's to say, there are a number of people in England and in most countries who, for one reason or another, receive police protection. I mean, government ministers, certain businessmen, certain judges, so on and so on, and me. The argument I've made throughout this time is that protecting people is not the same thing as concealing them. None of these other eminent people have been obliged to be concealed in the way that I was. And the point that I made was that, you know, I was very grateful to be offered protection, but I wanted something very much more like what was offered everyone else. And broadly speaking, that's what's happened. And so far, so good.
Well, whose call was that? How much power do you say, well, I want to go out now, so guards, come with me? Or do they tell you if you can go?
No, they don't. I mean, it's broadly speaking, it's my call. But, I mean, clearly there is a conversation about this that goes on between me and the police.
What was the worst period for you?
Well, actually, clearly it was in one sense was worst at the beginning, because it was very shocking and disorienting, and it was very it overturned many of my attitudes to the world, because I had to rethink all sorts of things. I mean, it was simply a huge shock. There's another sense in which it gets worse the longer it goes on. That's to say, it doesn't become easier for me to do this. It becomes, in ways that I'm perhaps not disclosing in this conversation, more stressful. There is a cumulative effect in this thing. And I think sometimes people assume that because I've put up with it for 6 years, I can put up with it indefinitely. Well, it's not true.
You know, it seems to me you've had to learn how to be two things at once. You've had to learn how to be at the center of international interest and at the same time how to learn to be invisible. Those are two really different extremes.
Yes, they are. It is very strange. I'm trying at the moment to be less invisible because it's the because that's a very frustrating thing to be. The international political thing, I must say, after 2 years in which I more or less worked flat out as a political campaigner and as a result was unable to do any work, I stopped doing that just over a year ago now. And the result of that has been the most productive year I can remember in years. I mean, this collection of stories and a finished novel. And I must say, that's made me feel a lot better than the previous 2 years. So I think the best thing I can do for myself now is just to be myself.
Was there a turning point for you when you thought, well, I'm not going to throw myself into this international campaign. I'm going to spend more time writing?
Well, I think, you know, once I'd been to America and met with President Clinton and other high officials at the White House, and when shortly after that I was able to address the European Parliament or a large chunk of it, I felt then that I had really done as much as I could usefully do in a campaigning way. That's to say, I'd been to see the leaders of most of the major countries of the free world and had been given strong assurances of their support. My feeling was, well, over to you, folks, and I'm going to go home and do my job. That's what I've been doing ever since. I wish they'd been doing theirs a bit better.
Do you have any taste for the cloak and dagger life, for the amount of secrecy and espionage that you've been involved with?
No, I loathe it. I mean, I really do. I think anybody who's known me for any length of time before this knows that I was always a very gregarious individual and actually a very unsecretive individual. So actually it couldn't have happened to a worse person, really. I mean, for a gregarious and unsecretive person to learn about isolation and secrecy is not easy.
How often, you have several guards from Scotland Yard, how long do they stay with you? How often do they change?
Well, I think actually I mustn't talk about procedural matters.
That's fine.
But broadly speaking, I've a lot of them have been with me for a long time, and I have got to know them very well.
I guess that's what I was wondering, how close you get with them.
Oh, yes. Well, I think I once joked with them that one of these days I could really take the lid off the special branch, and I think probably there is no writer in the world who's had such a detailed indoctrination, not indoctrination exactly, but entree to the world of secret police. And certainly, if I wanted to write a kind of John le Carré-style novel, I suspect I now could.
But you'd have no interest?
I don't know. You never know.
Right?
Never know. Never say never.
Salman Rushdie is my guest. He has a new collection of short stories called East West. More after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Salman Rushdie. My favorite of your stories in your new collection, East West, is a story at the end called The Quarter. And it's about a family that moves from, India to to England. And the family starts to unravel, and there's just a lot about what family means and what home means.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm wondering what home means to you now. The literal home you live in is one that you must keep secret, and I don't know if you stay in one place at a time or whether you have to rove around from night to night like you used to in the early days of the fatwa. But when you think of home, do you think of the place that you spend your nights in now, or is it something else that you think about?
No, I think, you see, I had to in some ways get rid of the idea of home at quite an early age. And that's to say, I came to England to go to school when I was 14 or so, and then my family also moved across the world quite a lot, and so the idea of the orthodox idea of home as being the place where you were born and raised and where your folks live and where you are known intimately is something which I really, for obvious reasons, just for the circumstances of my life, had to abandon quite early. So I've always had a rather gypsy notion of home, which I suppose has stood me in good stead in the last few years. But it nevertheless remains the case that the idea of home and of our attachment to the idea of place is something I've continued to write about all my life. I mean, the story you mentioned, The Quarter, I wanted to write about, and that's a story of the sort that I was talking earlier about, which is quite autobiographically motivated, in that it's true that my parents came to live in England for a couple of years when I was 16, 17 years old. And I had wanted to write about that curious passage of my life, partly because I wanted to write about what it was like to be young in the mid-60s, which was supposed to be such a groovy time, and kind of not to know where the fun was, you know.
It was the London, the England swings era.
It wasn't swinging in my vicinity. I wanted to know where the swinging was going on. So partly I wanted to write about that idea of to write about adolescence, to write about the first steps towards love and so on. And partly I wanted to write about what it was like to be displaced in that way. And partly I wanted to tell the story of this old couple having a kind of twilight autumnal love affair. And all those things came together into that story.
Well, getting back to the idea of home, which you discuss in that story, when you think of home now, it means something more abstract to you. What does it mean?
I suppose it means people, really. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's what it means to me. It means the people I care about. That's where I make my home.
In the story that we're talking about, which you say is pretty autobiographical, the main character, the narrator, who's around 16 or something, is watching his family fall apart. People are fighting. They don't really know where they're going to live. You know, loyalties between East and West are divided. And he says that he feels himself coming unstuck from the idea of family itself. Did you go through that during that phase of your life?
In something like that, yes. I mean, the sense in which the story is autobiographical is in the circumstances, I think most of the actual incidents in the story are not true. I mean, are made up. But it is true that there was a time in my teens when, I mean, after all, it's scarcely unusual for somebody to say this about being a teenager, when I wanted to run away from home, when I wanted to put as much distance as I possibly could between me and what I saw as a restricting environment. I had a difficult relationship with my father, and the story partly is about that too. And I wanted to put some distance between me and him.
Is your father still alive?
No, he's not. He's not been alive. So he died in 87. So he missed all this fun.
Where was he living then?
He was living by then in Pakistan. So, I mean, we were, you know, we made it up long ago. I mean, it was the kind of youthful quarrels didn't persist. But it's certainly true that it was a fairly tempestuous and dislocated time when my family was living in England, not only for me. Certainly I wanted to write about that, what happens to people when they are uprooted. But on the other hand, I think, you know, in of all people, I think America, a country in which everybody's come from somewhere else, one sometimes thinks, is a place in which what I'm talking about is, you know, is I would suspect, a very shared experience, that people start in one culture, end up in another, and have to spend a certain amount of their lives thinking about the implication of that, what in the story is called a double unbelonging, which could also be a double belonging. You could describe that either as having no roots or as having too many roots. I've always thought, for me, that it was that it gave me a lot of creative possibilities that I've been grateful for. I mean, I like the tension in the pulls between the East and the West, and it's something I've always tried to write out of and to maintain. The character in the story talks about not wanting to choose between the two cultures, and I think that's my view too. I want to have them both.
You've had to learn to live with a lot of restrictions in the past 6 years, and you've told us sometimes it gets very stressful. Have you learned different ways of coping with the stress and coping with the restrictions?
Well, yes, certainly I have, but I think mostly the way I've used is to struggle against the restrictions, is to try and reduce them, to try and get back as much freedom as possible. And there has been a steady movement towards that throughout this time, and I hope that will continue.
How has your health been?
That's, I must say, the one thing I have been very fortunate about. I've not, I mean, other than a minor problem of asthma and the need to have a couple of wisdom teeth pulled out in a hospital once, I've really not had any serious illness, touch wood. Might have been much more difficult if I had.
Do you do things to keep in shape?
Yeah, I sit with great tedium on an exercise machine for 45 minutes or so a day and make myself sweat.
I want to get back for a moment to the idea of the restrictions that you're living with and the boredom that can create.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a lot of us, when we're bored, what we do is eat a lot.
Oh, yes.
So yeah. I'm wondering if food has ever been too much of a temptation or a problem for you. It's just such a common thing to, when you're under pressure or when you're bored, you eat.
Oh, I see. Well, yes, there was a point where I put on some weight. It's gone now. This is radio, so I can't prove it to you. but I did, I mean, I have, I did, there was a point where I put on 20 or 30 pounds and I've basically lost them now. So I think I'm now back to something like the level of weight that I was at 4 or 5 years ago.
Did you do that through dieting or exercise?
Exercise mostly. I mean, that's why this dreadful machine. So yes, I think there was a point perhaps maybe 3 or 4 years ago where maybe I did put on weight because of boredom and misery. But it's all gone now.
When you have dreams, how often are you under the pressure of the fatwa in your dreams, and how often does that not exist?
Actually, I think I've never dreamed about the fatwa. I think it's present enough in my waking hours for my dreams not to need to bother with it. So I don't have very much memory of bad dreams. I've always slept very well, I'm happy to say.
Well, good.
Mm.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie, he has a new collection of short stories called East West. This is Fresh Air.